On this episode of The Big Number, we dive into the stats to answer these questions. Will Golden State and Jonathan Kuminga come to an agreement before training camp begins in 12 days? And if not, where else in the NBA could he realistically fit? Plus, we'll talk the latest on the Kawhi conspiracy. Alleged conspiracy. All this coming up right now. Welcome, 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 welcome to The Big Number. I am Tom Haberstroh, and that is our man, Dan Devine. Dan, we've got another week here at The Big Number HQ and also at the Yahoo Sports Network, our brand new streaming TV channel. Check us out, Yahoo Sports Network. It's available to stream on leading fast services. It's also streaming live 24/7 on yahoosports.tv. getoutofhere.com. It's now .tv, where you can watch all of your favorite shows on your phone or on your browser, which I have right now open because I'm looking at you, Dan. We've got a great week ahead of us in the NBA. Lots of news flying around. How you doing?
I'm hanging in, man. Training camp barreling down on us. We've got Adam Silver going up at various like conferences to discuss things that maybe he doesn't really want to talk about. Steve Ballmer, the same. We've got big inside the organization takeouts coming from major national news outlets. We've got all these things that we're trying to sort of sort out before teams get together to start figuring out how to play the NBA basketball. And as a result of that, Tom, I feel like it's time for us to put up some numbers. So hit me with it. What is this week's big number?
This week's big number is 9, Dan. 9, as in that's how many players, as we're recording this podcast today, that are signed by the Golden State Warriors to the standard contract. There's 9 guys on the roster. There's 9.
That's not a very big number, Tom.
No. And another number for you, Dan, to munch on is 12, as in there's 12 days before training camp starts for the Golden State Warriors. And they have half a team. They have half a team. All right, so here's the list. I've got it right here. Stephen Curry, Jimmy Butler, Draymond Green, Moses Moody, Buddy Hield, Brandon Pajemski, Guy Santos, Trace Jackson Davis, and Quinton Post. 9 guys.
It's a strong 9, but there's a name missing from that I thought was there.
Jonathan Kuminga is not on the list.
Right, him.
And neither is Al Horford or Seth Curry or D'Anthony Melton or GP2, guys who are rumored to be waiting in line for the Jonathan Kuminga sweepstakes to finally come to a resolution. But it seems like we're as far apart as we've been just based on the reports from The Athletic and ESPN. The Jonathan Kuminga standoff, the whole game of chicken, continues. According to ESPN this week, Kuminga and Joe Lacob met face-to-face, the owner of the Golden State Warriors, who has been staunchly in the camp of Jonathan Kuminga even before the NBA draft. And according to ESPN reports from Shams Charania, Anthony Slater, congratulations again, Anthony. This is all the way dating back to the draft that the Warriors front office and coaching staff were really big on guys like Franz Wagner. And yet, who did they select with the 7th overall pick in 2021? It was Jonathan Kuminga. And a lot of that had to do, reportedly, because of Joe Lacob. So Joe Lacob sits down with his restricted free agent. It's not getting where the Warriors want to be, and same vice versa with Kuminga's camp. They sit down, and according to the report, Joe Lacob says to the 22-year-old Jonathan Kuminga and says, "Do you even want to be here?" And Jonathan Kuminga responds, "Do you even want me?" Which, touche, Jonathan Kuminga.
We've arrived at the existential question at the heart of all of this. And that I feel like everybody involved really wants to say no, but the impasse here is contractually and in terms of roster management and in terms of asset management, maybe more important than all of it. No one really can say no. And so all summer long, we've talked a number of times on this podcast about restricted free agency and the deep freeze that players like Josh Giddey and Cam Thomas and Quentin Grimes and Jonathan Kuminga have found themselves in. Kuminga is the headliner of all of that, because while Cam Thomas went and took his qualifying offer, and Josh Giddey got his money. Quentin Grimes, we'll see. But Kuminga, it's the vibes, the feeling, the tenor and temperament of all of it seems the most negative and, yeah, the least progressive. The ESPN reporting suggested that there are some more offers on the table, some updated offers, but at the heart of it is still the control of the deal. It's the Warriors want Kuminga either to take a lower number for shorter years or a deal where in the out year, either the second year or the third year of a contract, they have the team option to decide what they want to do with it. Or if you get like a larger number in the short term, then you waive your implied no trade clause so that you can get moved, because really we would love to be able to get rid of you as soon as possible.
Yeah.
And Kuminga's saying, I want control. You guys have kind of jerked me around for 4 years in terms of my minutes and my opportunities, and whether that's understandable or not, I want to be able to exercise some control on what happens next. I don't want you to just shove me off someplace where, again, for the next few years, I don't get to control what I do. And if you want to have that team option, pay me more money. And so both sides are saying, I don't like what you're putting across the table. And yeah, I mean, there can be new proposals and deadlines spark action, you know, but we're coming up on a deadline here, not just the training camp one, but October 1st is the deadline date for Kuminga to sign that qualifying offer. And it seems like everybody just continues to be wondering who's going to blink first.
Yeah. Yeah. 12 days away. And look, this isn't just about Jonathan Kuminga. This is about a lot of players on other teams that are like waiting in limbo. Am I going to be traded for Jonathan Kuminga? Like, what's the deal? Training camp is around. Can I get some clarity here about where I'm going to suit up and start my season with? And also, Al Horford, he's just coming off a championship a couple years ago, and he's just sitting free agency waiting this out. And I don't know. I'd imagine Al Horford would like some certainty at this point in his career that he's not like all these games that they're playing in the contract situation, the negotiation with Jonathan Kuminga. Yes, he's been around the block a few times and understands that this is a business, but still there's like four players that are just waiting for this to be done so that they can get on with their lives. And I can guarantee you that Steve Kerr, Stephen Curry, Draymond Green, Jimmy Butler, they want to get on with this situation too, because they don't want this hanging over training camp. There's no way they want this to be hanging over their season, which is why this qualifying offer is so fascinating, Dan. Like you pointed out, the deadline is October 1st, and if he signs it, that's a horrible situation, I think, for both sides. I don't think either side wants to sign a qualifying offer, and obviously if he did, he would have already signed it by now. But there are four reasons that I see that if you're looking at this qualifying offer, what this does for the Golden State Warriors side, because it means he could walk at the end of the season as an unrestricted free agent. That's a big one, right? Is that you have Jonathan Kuminga, you have him for 4 years, and then he's basically a free agent at the end of the season. And he'd basically lose all of his trade value because, as Keith Smith points out over at SpotTrack.com in his write-up, any acquiring team is going to lose his bird rights to go above the cap, to re-sign a guy, go above the cap and essentially give him big raises and make it fortuitous for him to go to your team. Bird rights is really important here. And if he signs the qualifying offer, he's basically getting rid of that. And he's not extension eligible either. So if you acquire him and you're like, hey, I'll just sign you to an extension. No, you can't do that either. So you lose a lot of the trade value for Jonathan Kuminga. Not only is he an unrestricted free agent this upcoming season, next summer, but also if he signs for $8 million, Dan, how many guys are the Golden State Warriors going to be able to trade straight up with $8 million contract where both teams are like, yeah, that's a great deal? Like, it's not a big list.
It really limits the amount, because the whole idea, if you're the Warriors, so there's two potentially positive outcomes for the Warriors of this whatever Kuminga resolution it is. One is, I don't know, Jonathan Kuminga finds the particular flavor of religion you've been trying to get him to accept for 4 years. And it's like, you know what? I am going to devote myself entirely to being a defensive demon and a catch and shoot off ball player and heady, make the next play connective passer and all the things we've been desperate for him to be. which was really a huge ask for like a 19-year-old coming out of G League Ignite. It never totally made sense that they were like, this guy is going to fit perfectly in our, you know, the motion of the cosmos system.
So maybe don't draft him seventh overall is what I would say.
And maybe don't draft James Wiseman second overall. But this was the whole two timelines issue that we ran into, right? And so maybe we find the resolution and Jonathan Kuminga suddenly turns into the kind of high upside player they would like him to be, right? Or you get him on a deal that's 21, 22, whatever million dollars, because then you can go, if you trade him, bring in players who make up to that amount of money and a higher class, higher quality of player that maximizes your chances of building out a championship caliber roster around Stephen Curry. Because as it turns out, and as was always the case, the only timeline that matters is the one around Steph Curry.
That's right.
Him and Draymond Green and now Jimmy Butler, your mid-30s and above core, if you can get another high caliber role player in alongside those guys, that's what you're looking for. Those guys don't cost $8 million or $6 million or $4 million generally. So the Warriors, yeah, if you're absolutely right. If Kuminga takes the qualifying offer, they lose a massive aspect of their potential team building arsenal, something that they'd like to be able to have in their coffers. And Kuminga and his camp, his representative Aaron Turner, they know that. And they're saying, that's our leverage. You don't want us to take that because that hampers your ability to get something for us. And so let's come to the table and talk money. And so far, the Warriors have maybe been a little bit more reluctant to do that.
Yeah, and I think you're right. Aaron Turner and Jonathan Kuminga know this. And the fourth reason why I think this would be devastating for the Warriors, you don't want this hanging over the team for the whole season.
Sure.
That locker room, they don't need this. Like the biggest misnomer in this whole qualifying offer discussion is that if he takes the qualifying offer, he's not betting on himself. He's betting on Steve Kerr to let him get his opportunities and his shots and to blossom into the player that he thinks he is. If he takes the qualifying offer, he's got to trust that the Warriors and Steve Kerr are going to have his best interest to allow him to do the things he wants to do and to maximize his earning potential next year. And Steve Kerr and the Warriors are like, be more of a winning player. Attention to the details. The little things matter. Do those things, and then you become the player that everybody in the NBA wants on their team. And so there's a difference of opinion, but if he takes the qualifying offer, I don't think this is betting on himself, because so much of that means it rests in the hands of Steve Kerr calling you up off the bench. And when that happens, and when he trusts you, and when he doesn't. So it's an ugly situation right now. I do think that we've got some momentum here towards a deal, but like every time we do this, it feels like they get more entrenched. The offers are as such, according to reports. Warriors have offered a 3-year, $75 million with a team option in the third year, which is essentially a 2-year deal. Everyone needs to understand something. A team option is not a benefit for the player. A team option is a net negative. Like, you can say it's a 3-year deal, but to the player, that's worth less than a 2-year deal because you don't have control over that third year. If you do really well, the team's like, yeah, we'll pick up that team option and get you at a discount. But you don't have control. So like, yes, it's a 3-year deal, but it's essentially a 2-year deal at $25 million, which is half of the Josh Giddey deal in years committed, guaranteed. So can understand why Jonathan Kuminga doesn't want that. Can understand why the Warriors aren't willing to go 3 years with a lot of guarantees because they want to free up that money for, you know, 2 summers from now. The other thing is they have given them an offer reportedly of an average annual salary of $18 million, 3 years, $54 million contract, which would be well beneath Fred Katz. Our friend Fred Katz at The Athletic had a great survey of executives and people in the industry and what they think the average annual value of Jonathan Kuminga's restricted free agency deal would look like. And he had it at 20.4. And so Kuminga getting way well below what I think projections were would not be a great situation, and which is why I think he hasn't signed it yet, is because he thinks he can get more from that from the Warriors. So we both took the over on the 20.4 figure back, I think, in late July when we did the initial foray into restricted free agency. I think Jonathan Kuminga is an interesting player. I think he's kind of like Andrew Wiggins early in his career, in the sense that like lots of athleticism and talent, but it's going to take a while for him to leverage that and be in a situation and at a point in his career where he can realize I can't be that player and just get buckets and expect winning teams to want me. I got to change the way I am. And that's what happened with the Warriors when they got Andrew Wiggins and they made him into an all-star and a champion. Is I feel like maybe 5 years down the road or 6 years down the road, Jonathan Kuminga will be a winning player, a core member of a winning team. But right now, it's going to be a while before he does that. So I've got four landing spots that I like for Jonathan Kuminga. I'm not totally confident we're going to see him in any of those uniforms because this... There's base year compensation rules that makes things super complicated. It's not as easy, Dan, as just, oh, why don't they just trade this guy straight up? Their salaries match, blah, blah, blah. It's not that complicated. We don't have to get bogged down in the details. But I think Jonathan Kuminga has played his last day in a Golden State uniform. I don't know where he's going to go. I don't know if it's going to be a two-team or a three-team deal. But I don't like the way this is sounding. When you got Jonathan Kuminga clapping back at your owner, your billionaire owner, and saying, do you even want me? And having that leak out into the press doesn't feel like a good situation.
No, it does not. I'd note also that the reporting included the questions being posed to one another and not answers. So maybe it would be maybe worth noting that no one actually put that one in the communal pot for the reporter. The other thing is, we'll move on to talking about some potential destinations and some places that there might be an actual basketball fit. The basketball part of this all, as opposed to just the emotional part of it. My former coworker, the late great Jonathan Sharks, used to talk about players in terms of guys don't want to make the decision to fit into a role at 22. You know, like guys come into the league thinking they're all going to be Kobe. They're all going to be Jordan. They're all going to be a super duper star. And they want to have the opportunity to explore the studio space, you know, find out the depth, stretch the depths of their ability, see just how great they can be. They want to get the ball. They want to get the touches. They want to have the opportunities. And it's only after guys move past that, you know, maybe they succeed, maybe they don't, or something changes in their circumstances that then they might be ready to fit a role. So the Wiggins example, that's a number of years deep into his career after he'd gotten the max from Minnesota, after the, you know, multiple iterations of the Wolves didn't really pan out. And only after being moved do you then see, okay, there's a way for me to maximize my ability. And even that was kind of a mirage of like 1 year where it really worked out that way for the Warriors. So Kuminga, I think, is probably light years away from that point at this point. Whether he's far away from a new destination, I think, yeah, we're all going to be keeping an eye on that over the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, 22 years old. So you're betting that he's just figuring out who he is as an NBA player, and maybe a change of scenery will be best. That's what we're arguing here for a lot of these upcoming teams here. Right after the break, we're going to break down our favorite landing spots for Jonathan Kuminga. All right, 9 players, Dan, that are signed to contracts with the Golden State Warriors, and we're less than 2 weeks away from training camp opening, all resting on the whims of Jonathan Kuminga and Joe Lacob coming to an agreement on a contract or not, or maybe a sign and trade. We'll see. But if there is a sign and trade with Jonathan Kuminga, who would you like to see? Let's start your four little numbers with your first destination for Jonathan Kuminga.
All right. Want to just say briefly, I'm not smart, right? So like the idea of is all of this possible under existing sign and trade rules and with base your company? I have not done all of the math on this. I was trying to look at where, from a basketball perspective, would you like to see this player wind up? So that's sure. We'll start with that. So
I will refute your assertion that you are not smart, because a smart person would admit that. Smart person would boast like, I know everything in the cap rules and all that. You're smart to understand your limitations. And also you're just a swell guy, Dad. So
well done. Never said I wasn't swell. That I haven't, you know, swollen all of it. All right. Our four little numbers this week. First little number is 0.214. So small that it's under one. It's a decimal. 0.214. That was the Chicago Bulls free throw attempt rate last season. Free throw attempt rate is a stat that measures how often you shoot free throws compared to how often you shoot field goal attempts. Bigger number, more often you get to the line. Lower number, less often you get to the line. You want a bigger number because getting to the free throw line is a good thing. 0.214, second to last in the NBA last season, ahead of only the Boston Celtics, who obviously under Joe Mazzulla jack up a ton of threes, don't get into the paint a lot. So really low free throw attempt rate for the Chicago Bulls. Jonathan Kuminga's free throw attempt rate last season, 0.414, like 20% higher. That was the sixth highest mark of any non-center who played big minutes last season. Jimmy Butler, Giannis Antetokounmpo, James Harden, Denny Avdia, Paolo Banchero, Jonathan Kuminga. So what Jonathan Kuminga does as a basketball player, he's big, he's physical, 6'8", power wing. He gets downhill, he gets to the rim, gets into the paint, draws contact, and gets himself to the free throw line. The Bulls, we mentioned earlier, they extended Josh Giddey. They want to be an up-tempo team, a drive, a slash, a team that pushes the tempo, gets to the rim. His size, athleticism, and ability to generate free throws, Jonathan Kuminga would seem to be a fit there. And then with what the roster looks like, I don't think they would have too much of a problem moving away from Patrick Williams, or, you know, that hasn't seemed to work out super hot. Patrick Williams at the 3-4 spots for them. They have Matas Buzelis. They just drafted Noah Esenge, but they don't have like a top flight. This, we're putting everything into this guy as a scoring 3-4. There's been, you know, reports that the Bulls maybe have had some interest in Kuminga. What do you think of that fit on a basketball level? Like what Kuminga as a, you know, a like high, like an elevated option might look like for Chicago?
Got a stat for you, Dan.
Okay. I love
the last two seasons. The NBA average for total dunks, 779.
Okay. Cool number of dunks.
Chicago Bulls. Where do you think the Chicago Bulls land on that? If the average in the NBA is 779 dunks over the last two seasons, what would be the Chicago Bulls total? Just ballpark.
All right. Price is right rules. This is, you know, highest without going over. I'm going to go 613.
How about 513?
Wait a second. I had the last two. That's incredible that I got that right. But
you did. If the Price is Right rules and you had the one and the three on the board, I'd be in high suspense. I'd be sweating if you were like, grab the six, and the whole crowd's like, no, don't grab the six, grab the five. And you put it on the board. 513 dunks over the last two seasons.
Way
that
lower.
Is 103 fewer than the next lowest in the NBA. So they're 30th in the NBA, dead last in the number of dunks. And the next lowest team, the Memphis Grizzlies, have 618. They have half as many dunks as the Detroit Pistons and the Los Angeles Lakers. They have over 1,000 each. And the Chicago Bulls, they don't play with force. They play with pillows. Like they don't. They are a soft team, man. Like when you talk about the foul drawing and the dunks, like what does that add up to? Is a soft offense. So they need someone to play with more force. And I will say that Jonathan Kuminga, his 2-point field goal percentage dropped tremendously last season. His dunk rate fell by half last season. I think he wanted to be more of a show what I can do scoring wise. I'm not just a dunker. And his true shooting percentage fell all the way to about 53%. And I want to put that in perspective of the guys who have had 27 or more usage rate. So high usage rate guys, 42 of them in the NBA that had a usage rate of 27 or higher, according to stathead.com. Jonathan Kuminga ranked 40th in true shooting percentage out of 42 players. So he plays with force. He does get to the free throw line and he does get a bunch of dunks, or at least he did before last season. But he's still an inefficient scorer. And so that's where you kind of hope that in a new system under Billy Donovan in Chicago and with Josh Giddey and Kobe White at the helm, that they would be able to get him a lot more efficient looks and a lot more lobs and more athleticism. I do think that in terms of what the Bulls need, Jonathan Kuminga fits that. And also at the four position, I think they could use Jonathan Kuminga. So I like that as a landing spot, but I do want to see him get back to those like lob finishes and that athleticism getting out in the open court that he was earlier in his career.
And some of the decreased interior finishing might have stemmed from, they had ankle injury last year. You know, wasn't necessarily at his most explosive and springy when he came back later in the season. Might be an opportunity with full health and a new, you know, fresh coat of paint to get back up there. And interesting, you mentioned lob finishes and attack in the rim. So our second little number is 1.25. That's how many points per possession Jonathan Kuminga has scored in his career on plays where he rolls to the basket after setting a screen. According to our friends at Synergy Sports, Sport Radar, he's shooting about 60% from the field on those finishes. So 1.25 points per possession is pretty good for that kind of play when you're rolling to the rim after a dunk. Would have been like somewhere between the 65th and 80th percentile in the NBA the last handful of seasons. So it's not like elite, you know, where it's like DeAndre Jordan at his peak or, you know, Anthony Davis at his peak, but like pretty good. Mm-hmm. And then like a sub little number within this one is 91. Because that's all the possessions where he's actually done this over the last 4 years. So less than 25 a year for his whole career to this point.
So wait, at first I'm like, oh, he's really good at this as the numbers prove out, but also that he doesn't do this very often.
And why hasn't he done this very often? Well, what does Steve Kerr not really want to do a ton of, right? He doesn't want to run just pick and roll. In terms of the Warriors offense, which is some of that like consternation about how does Kuminga fit best here. And we know that when they are going to run pick and roll, it's going to be the Draymond Steph pick and roll, right? Like that's primarily what we're going to do. We're going to have Draymond setting the screen so that he can short roll, make decisions, spray out of that. So it made me think like, all right, hardly any opportunity to do this, has been pretty good at it when he's gotten the chance to do it. What if he went to a team that runs a lot more pick and roll? And doesn't have like a ton in the coffers as far as their four spot. So I started thinking, what about Charlotte? The Charlotte Hornets, sixth in the NBA last season in the share of their offensive possessions finished by a roll man under Charles Lee's first season on the bench, according to our friends at Synergy. LaMelo Ball, routinely among the highest volume pick and roll guards in the NBA in terms of how frequently he runs that action, finishes plays out of it. Charlotte's like most exciting moments in the last handful of years. You've seen it up close and personal. When you run in that two-man game with Miles Bridges, getting the ball up to him, lobs and throw it up there. If you kind of squint, you could see like, all right, 6'8", you know, 225 or so, big, springy, you know, athlete rolling to the rim or running the lane in transition. Maybe Jonathan Kuminga fits into that spot, especially Miles Bridges, I think only has one more guaranteed year after this year on his deal. And you're talking about a team that is retrofitting its timeline around 24-year-old LaMelo Ball, 22-year-old Brandon Miller, 20-year-old Con Knipple, 22-year-old Jonathan Kuminga maybe makes some sense there. Again, the mechanics of how you get him there, I'm not entirely positive on that, but just as a basketball fit, what do you think about that as a place where, again, Jonathan Kuminga maybe gets the opportunity to change the kinds of stuff that he does and maybe finds a better fit?
Yeah, so really interesting because I feel like he and Miles Bridges kind of overlap in their skill set in the sense that they're both like guys who envision themselves as all-star bucket getters, high flyers, dunkers, big-time dunkers, strong. And maybe you just get like a younger version of Miles Bridges. You know, people, Steve Kerr, Jonathan Kuminga's like rookie season, Steve Kerr kind of mentioned Sean Marion as a prototype of a guy who really runs the floor and a guy who at that size leveraged his athleticism to be a capable 3-point shooter, much better than I think people expected given where that shot was coming from, and was just a guy who played really hard defense and strong and an ability to defend and create turnovers. I could see why Steve Kerr floated that in front of Jonathan Kuminga and say, that's the type of player I want you to become. But what if he's more just Miles Bridges and he's just a 20-point scorer who's going to have, you know, some efficient nights where you just look at that and say, dude, that guy, I mean, he's a handful to deal with out there, right? And, you know, Miles Bridges, I don't think he fits in terms of the playing style that the Golden State Warriors want. If you look at their contracts, like, I don't know, like you said, where the deal kind of fits. I don't think we're going to see a LaMelo Ball trade, not just because of the contract, but man, they've got a lot of guys in the backcourt, and I just don't think that's going to work. But maybe a three-team deal, and we see Charlotte Hornets snag Jonathan Kuminga, who again, as you mentioned, 22 years old, about to turn 23, but fits their timeline. I like the Charlotte Hornets. I'm going to go. In a similar sense, a team that I think would like to get younger and fit a different timeline in the sense that I think this core is way too old and they need to find someone like Jonathan Kuminga, 22 years old. Sacramento Kings? Like, what are we doing, the Sacramento Kings?
Age-old question in Sacramento.
Who are you? Like, your starting lineup is... Dennis Schroeder, congratulations, Dennis Schroeder, future Hall of Famer, Dennis Schroeder, on winning gold with Team Germany. He's 32. Zach LaVine, 30 years old. DeMar DeRozan, 36 years old. The spring chicken, the youngest guy in this core, Keegan Murray, 25. And then Domantas Sabonis, 29. Average age of their starting lineup is 30.4. You're the Kings. Like, if you're this old, at your core is this old, and you're going to be hoping for 35 wins every year, you got a problem. And I think Jonathan Kuminga, in terms of how do you get younger and how do you find some bankable franchise cornerstones for the next 5 years, I don't know if it's a 30-year-old Zach LaVine or a 36-year-old DeMar DeRozan. Like, Domantas Sabonis, we've seen that. We know the ceiling on that. So I just kind of feel like Sacramento Kings, in a trade that would, you know, Keon Ellis might be going over to, Devin Carter might be going there. Malik Monk doesn't really make sense with the Warriors, I don't think. But I could see that deal getting done. But again, I don't love it. I just kind of feel like with Chicago and with Sacramento, it does fill a need in terms of youth and athleticism and two things that those teams really need.
Absolutely. And, you know, those are the two teams that have been, or two of the teams that have been most closely associated with the Kuminga sweepstakes, such as it is. The idea that Sacramento has been like, they're willing to make a sign and trade offer with a multi-year guaranteed deal to slot Kuminga into that starting four spot. I think it's funny, we've been talking about player, you know, where you would slot into your role. And I think what the Kings have been looking for is, like, they've never really found the defensive cover for, like, the big athletic four that can go next to Sabonis, that provides, you know, like the Aaron Gordon cover for Jokic, yes, or whatever, right? Like, that kind, perfect, of idea. I don't know that that's the kind of role that Jonathan Kuminga, like, can play. I mean, Aaron Gordon's a hell of a player.
Marion, Aaron Gordon, like, that would be best case scenario for Jonathan Kuminga. But totally. I think he thinks he's Kawhi.
And Aaron Gordon thought he was Paul George, right? In Orlando all those years ago, and wanted to have the ball in his hands and run pick and roll and have all the actions for him. So yeah, again, like, this is maybe a handful of years down the line. That's a model to maybe fit into. But I mean, in terms of organizations that are interested in importing him, Sacramento definitely up there on that list. You mentioned the idea of, like, there just aren't a whole lot of 20-point scorers in at this point in Charlotte. Maybe that you could bring in a guy like Kuminga to be that. Gets us to our third little number, 96. That's how many individual 20-point performances the Washington Wizards had last season. 96 20-point games. That's fewer than any team in the NBA besides the Brooklyn Nets. So that's, again, not great. Further not great, 57 of those 96 20-point games, that's about 60% of them, they're out the door. That was Jordan Poole, that was Kyle Kuzma, a few of them were Jonas Valanciunas. There was a couple of straight Colby Jones 20-point games late in the season.
Let's go.
Malcolm Brogdon was in there. All of which is to say, the Washington Wizards, who have been bad for a couple of years, and everybody knew they were going to be bad. This is the whole deconstruction phase after the Bradley Beal contract and all that kind of stuff. They need dudes who can score. And yes, CJ McCollum is there now, and Chris Middleton's there now, and you've got the second-year guy like Alex Saar and Bub Carrington and Keyshawn George. You've got Trey Johnson they just drafted in the first round. Cam Whitmore, which I'm kind of thinking, like, are they going to do the Spider-Man meme? Cam Whitmore and Jonathan Kuminga pointing at each other.
Yes.
But still plenty of question marks in terms of, like, who's going to form the offensive nucleus of whatever they're building in Washington. I can see an argument for saying, we know Kuminga can score. Whatever else we don't know about him, he can get the ball, he can go to the basket, maybe not always efficiently, but he can put up numbers. He is a 20-point caliber scorer in this league. Maybe Washington's an opportunity for him to stretch out and find out just how much he can do.
Yeah, I think if you're his agent, Aaron Turner, I think you're calling up the Wizards and seeing how they get involved in this situation, because they need the talent. You know, Chris Middleton, CJ McCollum are 34. Like, they're old vets. They're ready to pass the torch to whoever's coming in there. And I do think that would be a good landing spot for him. I think Phoenix is interesting.
Yes.
I think, God, I just want to say this. I think the framework of a deal would be there, except it involves Dylan Brooks joining Draymond Green and Steph Curry and potentially GP2, whom GP2 had his season ended because Dylan Brooks violently hit him in a fast break situation and he broke his elbow. and got suspended a few years ago. Dylan Brooks, I don't think, is best friends with Jimmy Butler and Draymond Green, but maybe.
No.
Hey, Chris Paul wasn't BFFs with Steph Curry and the Warriors and Steve Kerr beforehand. Well, I should throw out Steph Curry. They were fine. But Steve Kerr and Draymond, the whole Chris Paul thing, and they were fine together, right? So, like, maybe here's the deal that I like. Dylan Brooks and Oso Iguodala would be really interesting for the Warriors, especially because I think the Phoenix Suns have like 18 centers on their roster. They just have a bunch of guards. And then like all of the Charlotte Hornets centers, Mark Williams and Malawach also from Duke. And then they got Nick Richards on the roster too. So I think Iguodala, like where does he find minutes on this team? Maybe at the four, I don't know. But I would, if I'm the Warriors, take a flyer on him. And Dylan Brooks, kind of as a 3-and-D guy, grinder on your team. Just personality aside, makes a lot of sense. So I like Phoenix as a landing spot for Jonathan Kuminga, also 22 years old, for the reasons that they're not going to be able to build through the draft in the next 5 years. And so getting guys who are untapped potential in Jonathan Kuminga at a young age, get those flyers, bring them in and see what you have. I think that makes some sense from the Phoenix side.
I was just thinking about what, if you're Devin Booker, what are you thinking as you look around at the, you know, that you were in the finals a few years ago and you look around on your roster, is the Charlotte Hornets center rotation, Jonathan Kuminga, Jalen Green, and I don't know, Colin Gillespie. And maybe you're thinking, well, it's a good thing I got that $75 million a year contract extension in the offseason.
Is it, is it Kuminga kind of like a big Jalen Green? Just like, it, don't really know if he's a winning player yet. Super young, athletic, gets buckets, but like inefficiently high usage guy. Like, again, Kuminga on the Warriors had a 27% usage rate, which is on any other team, like inflation wise, like that's like a 31% usage rate, because the Warriors, they don't want high usage guys. They want to spread the ball, egalitarian offense. And so I can only imagine Kuminga, Book, and Jalen Green fighting over the ball in Phoenix. That would be fun. Get your popcorn. You think Dylan Brooks in a Warriors uniform would be interesting? Like, that would be, whew, that'd be tough.
The idea of the deal, the daily drama of Draymond, Jimmy, and Dylan Brooks would be, it's worth signing up for. Anyway, let's get to our fourth and final little number. Two. That is the number of top 10 picks that currently reside on the roster of the Brooklyn Nets. And those two are swingman Zaire Williams, who the Grizzlies drafted 10th overall in 2021. And Yegor Dioman. So he said, that's how he says his name. All right. I don't know that I'm right, but he said it. Yegor Dioman, the rookie out of BYU that the Nets just drafted with the number 8 pick in June as part of their drafting of 5 dudes in the first round. As a result of all the trades they made back, you know, going through the KD and Kyrie and Harden era and all the picks out the door and all that stuff, Brooklyn's roster is mostly like mid to late first round picks, second round guys, and undrafted dart throws. Like they're churning through guys to try to find bankable NBA talent. Doesn't mean they're devoid of talent. They do have Cam Thomas, who turned into a really good scorer with the 27th pick. They just drafted, or just traded for, rather, Michael Porter Jr. Again, they just drafted 5 guys in the first round. And so maybe some of those turn out to be really good. But the Nets they finished 23rd and 28th in offensive efficiency the last 2 seasons. They got the 7th worst winning percentage in the league over the last 2 seasons. They're not good, and they're probably not going to get good real soon, especially when they're not drafting up at the top of the draft. So on the hunt for more talent, Jonathan Kuminga, number 7 overall pick, lottery caliber talent, has shown he can be a 20-point scorer in the NBA. And the last time the Nets bottomed out without a whole bunch of great draft picks, the things started to kind of turn around for them when they went and they got a distressed asset out of California, D'Angelo Russell, and they rehabbed him into an all-star. Maybe history repeats itself with Jonathan Kuminga. What say you, Tom?
It's the default option for me is Brooklyn, just because they have such a talent void. And Cam Thomas already on the qualifying offer. Jonathan Kuminga coming off this, you know, I want to prove myself and go get, you know, 25 points a game. That would be also grab your popcorn, Michael Jackson meme, you know. I got another team, Detroit. Detroit, I was looking for teams that could use a young player, high flyer, who also have like a rim protecting 5 that you could play with JK, you know,
because like
you got Beef Stew and Jalen Duren. I feel like if you're going to have Jonathan Kuminga at the four, you need some more muscle back there to be a rim protector, because I don't think Kuminga is going to be that guy for you. And so I kind of like the fit there. And also Tobias Harris, you know, where he is at his career, I don't think he's, you know, a long-term option there, keeping the seat warm for whoever the long-term four is. Maybe that's Kuminga. And they had, I think, if not the most dunks last season, they were right up there. So in terms of like playing style and the high pick and roll with Cade Cunningham running downhill and having a lob threat in Jonathan Kuminga and Jalen Duren and Beef Stew, Isaiah Stewart, I kind of feel like JB Bickerstaff would have a lot of fun with Jonathan Kuminga in his lineup. So that's another team that I'm interested in.
Yeah, I think the idea of like what your spacing looks like if you've got Kuminga in those actions more, and then like where is Jalen Duren, where is Asar Thompson on that team? You know, like you're trying to, like, they got made a lot of hay out of like Duren up at the high post and Asar on the back line. But then if you introduce Kuminga into that, does that complete? I think there might be some geometry issues there, but that's, I think, of the teams we talked about, that's the one where there's the arrows pointed upward. You know, we've got proof of concept with the way the Pistons played last year. And we know that they've, you know, you've got a hell of an operator in Cade Cunningham in the two-man game to find guys and get guys shots. So, yeah, I mean, I think what we're, our takeaway here, and I know we've gone a little bit long in this discussion, is like, it's tricky to find a really good, not just contractual fit, but also basketball fit for Jonathan Kuminga that gives him the minutes and the starting opportunity and the touches and the usage that he's looking for, and also is like a good basketball situation where you can compete. It might be a pretty tricky needle to thread, let alone when you get to what are the assets coming back to Golden State? Is that going to be something that they're interested in? And, you know, is the contractual component of it for Kuminga going to be where he and his representatives want it? And I think all of that is to say, we maybe have arrived at, this is why this has been hard for the last few months, and why, as we are on the eve of training camp, we still don't have an answer and the Warriors still don't have a roster.
The overlapping team in our four teams or landing spots is the Chicago Bulls, who, according to the ESPN report, they offered Alex Caruso for Jonathan Kuminga and the Warriors turned it down 2 years ago. So what if Alex Caruso, you could have gotten Jonathan Kuminga, but you instead get Josh Giddey and Jonathan Kuminga? How about that?
And can you think of a guy who might be pretty good on the Golden State Warriors in that system that they run there? Alex Caruso, maybe?
I mean, come on. Is there a better fit than Alex Caruso on the Golden State Warriors?
Creepers.
The way that Steve Kerr wants to play. So we talked a lot about Kuminga wanting control in this, and how Joe Lacob, even if he's a billionaire, doesn't seem to have control over this situation as much as he'd like. We're going to talk about Steve Ballmer and Adam Silver and Kawhi Leonard and Pablo Torre's continued reporting right after this. All right, so the latest in the Kawhi Leonard story, the saga that continues. Again, we're, 12 days away from training camp? That could have been the big number at the top, because it also fits thematically with what's happening with the Kawhi Leonard story and the uncertainty of how the NBA is going to handle this situation. This bombshell report from Pablo Torre a couple weeks ago, maybe not even 2 weeks. I don't even know if it's been 2 weeks. It feels like this has been a month because of all the reports that are coming out. And we had this week on Tuesday, not only Adam Silver being on a panel at a conference, but also Steve Ballmer was at the SBJ conference on Tuesday and had some on the record comments about the investigation. But on Tuesday afternoon, Pablo Torre on his Twitter account had mentioned after the September 10th NBA owners meeting, Adam Silver said, quote, "I'd frankly never heard of the company Aspiration before, and I'd never heard a whiff of anything around in an endorsement deal with Kawhi or anything around engagement with the Los Angeles Clippers. So it was all new to me." When he said that, end quote. When he said that, Dan, I was on Yahoo Sports Daily, the Daily Show, right? I was on that morning, and that was like the first thing that jumped out to me was Adam Silver was arguing that he had never even heard of aspiration, which is kind of confusing because the deal was for over $300 million, Dan.
Right.
Don't you think that the Adam Silver in the front office, he comes from NBA Entertainment with under David Stern, would hold this up and be like, we got a $300 million non-naming right sponsorship for a team that has never won a championship or even been to the NBA Finals. And they signed up with a $300 million sponsorship deal. And I'd imagine this went across his desk and that he had seen this because Steve Ballmer is very close with Adam Silver. Of course, this is the upcoming NBA All-Star game is at Intuit Dome, and it's Steve Ballmer is slated to be the face of this big moment for the NBA and NBC and the Olympics. And it's all coming to a head here because in the Tuesday sit down with FOS, Front Office Sports, Adam Silver said, if I said I never heard of it, I meant in the context of the accusations here, I was certainly aware of the brand. That's different than what he said a few days
ago. It is.
In style and in substance, it was very different. The tone a few days ago at the Board of Governors meeting was, I had never heard of this company. This is the first I'm hearing about it. Basically had his head in the sand compared to what I think if you're looking at $300 million contract with Steve Ballmer's, this is the Clippers. This is a huge deal. And then Pablo Torre reporting, hey, these all have to be signed. These kind of contracts have to be like audited and vetted by the NBA. And the NBA had to have done that in order for this to go through. So Adam Silver changes his tune on this a little bit, saying, oh, I was aware of the brand. But man, it just stinks to high heaven, Dan. The fact that Adam Silver has changed his stance on this just a few days ago. And from the reporting from Pablo Torre that Steve Ballmer is on the audit committee for the NBA. And I believe, sorry, Sam Amick over at The Athletic reporting that he is the chairman of the audit committee for the NBA at the Board of Governors. So this it smells bad, Dan. It smells really bad. And it feels like it keeps getting stinkier.
So, and this is the thing that has struck me so much about it. Like, we look at this, and I think a lot of people look at this and are like, all of these things lining up and the timing of these things and who knew what when, and all the kind of the aspects of Pablo's reporting and then subsequent reporting by people like Sam and like Mike Vorkunoff at The Athletic and other people who have picked up on the scent of the story and continue to move with it. It looks to us or to lay people and to especially and to sort of general fans like this can't possibly all be a coincidence. And as a result of this, something really untoward has happened here. And Adam Silver, as a lawyer by trade and mm-hmm. the people who are making these sorts of choices are like, I refuse to move through that and move to a conclusion based on these appearances or the smell, right? Like, I can't just say this stinks, so something died. I have to go make sure something died. And the other, and the Mark Cuban component of this, where he obviously has been very public and loud and tweeting, you know, like Dan Devine length stories on about the issues trying to poke holes in Pablo's reporting and the dot connecting, keeps talking about like, you know, you can't really understand the complexities of this if you're not familiar with the deal side or the deal space. Or like, I think this is where the rubber's meeting the road in terms of fan reaction to this. It's like, it feels like you guys are just trying to put one over on us, continuing to say like, you don't really understand the deal issue here. And that was something that Adam Silver said in that Front Office Sports interview where like talking about like it being hard for people to believe that their league or the team wasn't aware of what was going on with this. And he says, like, we can hire outside law firms. We have some inside investigators, but there are literally thousands of deals that cover all our teams. These are brands that have major investors, major funds. I was certainly clear of the crypto world at the time. So yes, there's a league approval process, but it doesn't go deep into interviewing executives for every deal that comes through the league office. And the interviewer, Daniel Roberts, who used to work for us at Yahoo Finance, said, I think that, or should it? Like, does it need to go through the league office on that level? And Adam Silver said, I think that's a fair question, and maybe at a certain level they do. I think we'll have a better sense when we understand what happened here. It's like the fan is looking at this and saying, how can it be possible that you guys don't know what all is happening here? And someone like Cuban, someone like Ballmer, someone like Silver are looking at it and saying, well, we can't possibly keep track of all of this stuff. Like, there's so much money here. There's so many deals going on here. How do you expect us to be able to catch all of this? And I think the fan looks at that and says, that's how fraud happens. Like, if no one's looking, then that's how, if you guys can't possibly catch all of it, then maybe you should do less of it. But the answer to that is like, well, we live in a market-based economy, and of course we're not going to do less of it because there's money to be made. And when there's money to be made, then somebody's going to be like, no one's looking, we're going to do something shady. And we wind up going like, then you have an uneven playing field, and then you have stuff like this that can happen. And they're saying, yeah, but like, that's not really what's going on. Like, don't pay too much attention to what's going on over there. And then the jersey sponsors and the, you know, private equity money's coming in over here. And then you wind up like, who winds up getting sort of the short shrift on this is like, if you're a fan of a team that can't do this sort of deal. That's really who winds up getting screwed over in this situation. And so all of it winds up coming down to if you can't possibly have the level of oversight over all these deals, and if someone's due diligence team was asleep at the wheel, and then this can happen, then maybe the size of the due diligence teams, the size of the investigative arm, the way this is all sort of structured should be beefed up. And I think that's where Adam Silver is now saying, we'll know, have a better sense of what happened at the end of this, and then maybe we need to make some changes and redraw some lines.
Yeah. What is the Shakespeare line? Like, the lady doth protest too much, you know? It reminds me of when Mark Cuban's like tweeting out these missives of like thousands and thousands of words. It reminds me of like when my kids are like trying to explain that they didn't spill the ice cream onto the couch, you know, and they come up and like, what happened here? And they're like, oh, well, and then they just keep going for like 10 minutes explaining how it wasn't their fault. And I'm like, if it takes you 10 minutes to explain what happened here, maybe you're not telling the whole truth. Like, if it is that complex that it takes 7,000 words to explain why this isn't fraud or why this isn't it's cap circumvention, if it takes 10,000 words to explain why, then maybe it's not too complex. You're just trying to make it too complex to just have it go over everybody's head and say, you know what, I'm not going to read all that. Maybe you're right, Mark.
Like, but Tom, that's the thing too. Like, you don't understand the deal structures and the deal space. The regular people didn't understand, like, securities-backed... Or the housing bubble, collateralized debt obligations. And what happened there was not like, well, you guys just don't get it, don't worry about it. What happened there is like fraud and bad things happening, and the people who do, it is increasing the complexity of these things so that only a few people understand them, so that those are the people who can make money off of them, and then the rest of the general population just winds up sort of shouldering the burden for it. And so, like, not to say that Steve Ballmer potentially, allegedly, whatever, funding a no-show job for a player to circumvent the salary cap is the same as like the mortgage bubble. But like the idea of, if you are sort of creating or crafting this level of complexity, this layer of complexity to obfuscate what is actually going on underneath it, that you're doing that for a reason, or at least you allow the fan to look at it and say that is happening for a reason, and it is to hide something from us so that we don't get to know what it is. And why would that be the case? So Adam Silver going out, and I completely understand that idea of like, we start from a presumption of innocence rather than guilt, even though like the league at large is not doing that. And even though fans are certainly not doing that, we are operating from that position, and we will see where we are at the end of the investigation. I think the overarching thing I take away from all this is like, the more everybody tells me as a layperson, you just don't understand why this should be this way, the more I think maybe it shouldn't be that way.
Yeah, your eyes are rolling in the back of your head so far that it's come all the way around. It's like, come on, that it's too complicated. You wouldn't understand. Pablo, you've never run a Fortune 500 company. You don't understand what it's like. And it's just like, come on. Pablo had like 3,000 pages on his table during that first episode. And I saw someone on X say, like, joke, like, that's actually Mark Cuban's tweets. They printed out his tweets. Look, Steve Ballmer, to wrap this up, Steve Ballmer also spoke at the SBJ convention or conference, a separate one compared to the front office sports convention. And he had a lot of awkward laughter trying to, I think, curry some sympathy here from the audience, and the whole line of "I got conned" that he told to Ramona Shelburne on ESPN hours after the story broke. He's playing the victim here, right? He's playing the victim. And by saying like, "Yeah, I got conned, and man, this is, I welcome the investigation, and I'm happy that they're doing it, because it'll be great when the details come out." And from a PR strategy, I think it is, it does convey a sense of confidence and a sense of, "I have nothing left to hide." But in that Ramona Shelburne interview, did he mention that he also invested $10 million more, as Mike Vorkunov initially reported at The Athletic, and put in a lot more money, or more money again? It doesn't seem like, if it was a total con, that while all this stuff is going on, you're like, "I'm going to put more money into this company." And Dennis Wong, my co-owner and my longtime confidant and my college roommate, is also going to put $2 more million, which in size and in substance is the same size of the payment that is due for Kawhi Leonard, and then Kawhi Leonard gets paid. It doesn't feel like when is the con up? Like, are you part of the con, or are you just an innocent bystander? Because I think fans are also looking at this and like, man, they're so intermingled, these two parties, the Clippers and Aspiration. And then you got Adam Silver saying, "I've never heard of this company." At some point, the fans just got to throw their hands up and be like, is anyone going to take accountability for this? Is anyone going to take accountability for a cap circumvention regarding Kawhi Leonard? And if they don't, as I said this last week, if they don't hold anyone accountable for what just went down, every team in the NBA is going to be like, "Oh, what shell company can I funnel this money through?" Because if this is all it takes, fine. $28 million to one of my free agents that we're going to sign, or hope that we're going to have it to an extension. And as long as we don't have it in writing, "Hey, this is for Kawhi Leonard to circumvent the cap," we can get off. Oh, great. So I can understand why a lot of fans are sitting here and being like, this is a huge deal. Why does it feel like the commissioner is backtracking? And also, why does it feel like, I don't know, if I was the commissioner, or if David Stern was the commissioner, I kind of feel like the tone would be like, this is a cardinal sin in the NBA. We're taking this extremely seriously, and the allegations are alarming. And for this to happen with Kawhi Leonard, of all players, one of the best players in NBA history, this cuts to the core of the integrity of the NBA. And you better believe we are going to do everything we can to figure out exactly what happened here, because the allegations are extremely serious. And we understand, as a league, we cannot let this happen. The opposite seems to be happening in terms of the PR of this, is that it's like, hey, we gotta let this thing settle. And at the end of his press conference at Board of Governors, he mentioned the integrity of the league. But I would have rather, if I'm a fan, see the commissioner start with the integrity of the league, because that's the most important thing here.
Yeah, I mean, at the risk of being a little bit of a doomer, I would say let's not all collectively hold our breath until somebody takes accountability for all this. Adam Silver said, "I certainly don't know anything at all about Kawhi's deal, whether it was show, no show, I don't know, and we'll find all that out."
If it was a no-show, when was the last time the NBA saw an Aspiration endorsement from Kawhi Leonard? I don't know anything about the endorsement deal. He could say, "I haven't seen a single thing. I have not seen to this day anything that Aspiration has put out with Kawhi Leonard, but I am open to have my mind changed." Like, I have no idea if it was a no-show agreement. We certainly know that there was a no-show in Kawhi Leonard and one of the biggest sponsorship deals in NBA history, 300, if not the most. Hey, if you're out there and you know of a sponsorship deal, non-naming rights deal, that was more than $300 million, let me know, because I think that's got to be the record. And man, I just feel like I don't know anything about the endorsement deal. I mean, we do know that he did no endorsing. We can all agree on that, that there was no endorsing as far as anyone has seen since the story broke a couple years ago. We have not seen actual endorsing going on with Kawhi Leonard.
Yeah. I mean, where we are now is just, you know, who knows where this goes from here, but it's not, I think what we've heard and what we've seen so far, we don't want to have the rush to judgment, but I think also the NBA, the onus is on the NBA to show fans they're actually taking this seriously. And I don't know necessarily that what we've seen so far rises to that level. Who knows? More will be revealed.
That's right. Next week on The Big Number, we're going to spend another hour and 20 minutes talking about Jonathan. I'm just kidding. Well, maybe we'll have some sort of deal to react to. I'm rooting for it. Also rooting for me to mispronounce that that Brooklyn Nets player. His
Yegor Dioman. We got this. We're locked
Yegor
in.
Yegor Dioman.
Yegor Dioman.
Because I want to impress our producer, BYU Cougar, Emmy Franks. Thanks so much for producing this show, and everybody else at Yahoo Sports for making this show happen. And also, as a reminder, go check out yahoosports.tv and our fast channel, Yahoo Sports Network. Go check it out. You can watch The Big Number and all the other great content that we have at Yahoo Sports. Dan, until then, have a great week. Have a great weekend, and we'll talk soon.
It's an ongoing investigation, Tom.
It's a highlight. I hope we see a lot of highlights from this podcast that we did, Dan.
I hope so too.
Let's see some clips.